It's Todd Zola and Ray Murphy talking about what's gone on in spring training and their 2024 boons and banes on a special opening day roundtable edition next on Baseball HQ Radio.
Learn to play the winner's way, because Baseball HQ Radio starts right now. And here's your host from BaseballHQ.com, columnist Patrick Davitt.
And welcome to Baseball HQ Radio for Friday, March the 29th. It's show number 10 of the 2024 fantasy baseball season. I am Patrick Davitt, your host, and we do have another great roundtable edition for you. We'll have our two traditional roundtable guests, Todd Zola from Masters Ball, ESPN, RotoWire, and SiriusXM, and Ray Murphy from BaseballHQ.com. In part one of our discussion, we'll talk about end of spring slash opening day news storylines, including changes in Shohei Ohtani's fantasy value, Jackson Holliday's demotion, JD Martinez's signing, and more. And then in part two, we'll have our opening day boons and banes, including Tim Anderson, CJ Abrams, Mitch Keller, Tyler Glasnow, and a whole bunch more boons and a whole bunch more banes. We'll also have our regular commentaries from the analysts at BaseballHQ.com, the best fantasy baseball website in the business. In the Minor League Minute, Baseball HQ scouting team member Rob Gordon has his final spring training report. In the Frequent Flyer, Baseball HQ analyst Alex Becky looks at Boston shortstop outfielder Sidan Rafaela. And in Extra Innings, I'll be talking about whether two fantasy managers can use the Doug Dennis no-starting pitcher strategy without sinking both teams. It's another big roundtable edition. Thanks for joining us here at Baseball HQ Radio. Hey, what do you say? We got Todd Zola, we got Ray Murphy, and we got to talk some baseball. And to start our special roundtable edition, let me introduce our two panelists. First, from Masters Ball, RotoWire, ESPN, and SiriusXM, our favorite guest expert and a regular guest here at Baseball HQ Radio, it's Todd Zola. Todd, welcome back to the pod.
You call all your guests your favorite, PD. Great to be back with you guys. This means it's baseball season, right?
That's exactly what it means. And in this corner, the co-general manager, projections manager, analyst, and writer at BaseballHQ.com, and our regular news guy here at Baseball HQ Radio, it's Ray Murphy. Ray, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here as always, PD. I've got a point of order, though. You said I'm in this corner, but I think this is a round table, so I need a better geometric reference point for how we're organized here.
All right. On this chord, is that a thing on a side of a circle? I don't know. Let's start this show with one final look at the tail end of spring training. And the big story that I'm curious what you guys think is the strange saga of Shohei Ohtani and his interpreter. We don't need to rehash the whole story, but as of right now, if you were drafting this weekend, how would you be thinking about Shohei Ohtani as a fantasy question? Todd, start us off.
Okay, so as a projectionist, as a prognosticator, I talked to some people, and all right, a projection is a weighted average of plausible outcomes, and you can make an argument that even if Shohei Ohtani doesn't lose any games, it gets to him mentally, and his performance dips a bit. So you should probably, at minimum, drop the performance level a bit. I didn't. We decided was... Everybody knows what to do. Everybody knows the deal, and they can decide what they want to do. So I didn't change my projection. As a drafter, if I was into Shohei Ohtani before, I'm into him now. And now maybe I get a little bit better of an opportunity to draft him if he does fall a little bit. It's a cop-out to say, I'm not interested. You're not the answer you want. I think if you were interested before, you stay interested in, and you show it by – potentially getting a break by either if you're at the wheel, you don't take him in the first round, you take him in the second round, something like that.
Ray, what do you think?
I largely agree. I think we've seen enough data since the news broke that in terms of ADP, there was some mild downward pressure on Ohtani's value there. So I think Todd's right that it's a slight discount, but it wasn't even a full round. It's exactly what Todd said. It's if you're picking at the end of the snake, you can take him with your second rounder instead of your first rounder if you want to. It's not exactly groundbreaking. I totally agree that in terms of projection systems, I prefer more concrete, less soft, touchy-feely stuff to force me to put my finger on the projections scale, and this didn't rise to that level for me. Would I have been a little less likely to draft him? Probably. It turned out I didn't have an opportunity, but compared to the news cycle impact, which of course is undoubtedly significant, to me the fantasy value impact is smaller and less easily quantifiable. So to Todd's point, it's hard to do anything about it significantly from either perspective, the player drafter perspective or the prognosticator perspective.
I'm with Todd. I don't think that we can price in any kind of mental anguish or whatever that soft, touchy-feely thing that Ray talked about can be priced in accurately. But what I am concerned about a little bit is playing time risk. The playing time risk being that he gets caught having been, playing the... He could be the guy who's placing the bets and the other guy being a beard, and Major League Baseball finds out about it and he gets the Pete Rose treatment. Now, I don't think that's likely, but how do you price in that risk, Ray?
I was more worried about that risk before his statement came out. When he gave the statement and, flat denied ever gambling on any sport, essentially. I mean, that's, to your point, that there's only two outcomes there. Either, as you say, it reduces the possibility of that outcome, or he really is, if he's that deep in denial, it really does open the door to the Pete Rose scenario, right? But I think the higher likelihood there is that, it actually does reduce his exposure, except at the very tail end of the outcome curves. The other thing about this that, has been discussed in our forums with some extent is the federal investigation. All that aspect of it is likely to be pretty slow moving. Otani's not the primary target of that. The bookmaker is. So even in terms of lost playing time risk, I think it's entirely likely that without even trying that hard, Otani, his lawyers, his team, and MLB can get all of this pushed out past the end of the season before there's any resolution that casts a shadow on Otani's playing time. So I'm actually not that worried about that.
And Major League Baseball, of course, has a vested interest in making sure that Shohei Otani survives the season, because he's pretty much the face of the game, especially internationally, and that's not nothing for Major League Baseball. Todd, what do you think about the playing time risk?
Well, I think, plausible outcomes, that is one. And again, is a plausible outcome he gets suspended tomorrow? What's the chances? Midseason, so you want to get numbery about it, 10%, 1%. Sure, so you drop it. To me, it's still kind of a hand waving. I'm not putting a calculator to it. I understand it, and either I don't believe he's going to get suspended, so I'm still all in. It's just I don't think we can quantify. We try to, as Ray kind of suggested, we want to be able to quantify our plausible outcome. We want to have some rationale, some data to construct our plausible outcome. It's still more subjective. And we could find out, but the fact that he MLB, they know things already. And I don't know that he would have been playing in Korea, et cetera, if there was any concern that something was going to happen.
I talked earlier this week with Doug Dennis, the bullpen's columnist at baseballhq.com. He brought our audience up to date on the bullpens at that time, but there's a lot of news going on in bullpens the last couple of weeks of spring training. And in the early going, and basically day one, we had Robert Suarez picked up his second save of the season. Clay Holmes picked up a save but looked terrible doing it. Griffin Jacks got the save in Minnesota. The Tigers went with Jason Foley and not Alex Lang, albeit not in a real high leverage sort of save situation. So how should fantasy managers be approaching the closer situation in general, Ray?
The thing that's changed in this space for me over the last decade or so is when you're reading the tea leaves about these closers and closer candidates, we don't see nearly as much of the closer who gets the job but doesn't have the skills to hold it. In this day and age of these relievers with these who, you know, are optimized for throwing 15 pitches and slider monsters and all of that unhittable stuff coming out of the pen, most of the guys in the bullpen can get three outs and protect a three-run lead. So, you know, the this guy can't be a closer isn't really a thing anymore as much as it was back in the day. But that still leaves two aspects to this. There's if you're still drafting this weekend, where there are many more unsettled bullpens than there were even 2 weeks ago because of injuries and guys who are starting the season in the role or guys who are, you know, trying to transition into the role. And, you know, it off the cuff tells me that you want to pay up for the stable guys. But the problem with that is the price for the stable guys go up. And the other problem is the stable guys are only stable until they're not, which is, as we're seeing this week, can bite you even in places that you didn't think it was going to blow up. 10 days ago, we all thought Jovan Duran was a stable closer. Now he's out for a while. But the thing that to pay attention to is I think it's more important than ever who gets the first save op in Milwaukee, or that we confirmed yesterday that it's Griffin Jacks ahead of Brock Stewart, because almost all of these guys are capable of holding the role. If you're betting on my favorite from the offseason, Trevor McGill in Milwaukee, and it turns out that it's Joel Piamps, that doesn't necessarily mean that you just hold McGill, because you're confident Piamps is going to blow up and in 2 weeks the wheel will turn back to McGill and you just have to be patient. That's not necessarily the case, because Piamps, Uribe, McGill, they're probably all capable of being a solid major league closer until Dev Williams comes back. And it really just is the question of who Pat Murphy's going to tap there. So once we find out who he taps, you might be better off fishing somewhere else.
Todd, what do you think about the closer situation given the volatility of it all?
I think what you need to keep in mind, and I don't have the exact numbers because I don't draft towards targets, but the number of saves needed, I don't care if it's NFBC or whatever, the way that NMLB is distributing them, you don't need as many saves as you did 3, 4, 5 years ago. So if you get one guy who's going to still give you 35 or 40 saves, you are a lot closer to what you need than you were a few years ago. So I think you have to worry about one fewer spot. You don't need 2.5 closers anymore. You need 1.5. And if you've got your one, you'd only need the half. If you don't have your one, you only need one. So I think that's the thing too, is people, you want to take a closer early, fine, it's your dime. You want to take two closers early, I'll talk about you on my podcast, because I think that's silly. You know, I think you have to keep in mind, you don't need as many saves. And I don't know, Ray, as far as if you get the first save, I'm not convinced as I was previously that you're going to get the second anymore. I think there's some managers who I'm playing the matchups. I'm curious what happens with the Cubs. Albert Alzolay did not have such a great outing. Is he still the guy? Is Norris going to get the next shot? We don't know what Craig Council's going to do. I know that's opposite what Ray said, you know, is he didn't get the save. But I think if Piamps get the first one, I wouldn't be surprised if it's McGill that gets a second. I think there's some chance, some places where it may be curious.
And as Doug Dennis and I talked about earlier this week, Council basically said he wasn't going to have a closer. He said he was right. Going to roll it around, and maybe we have to take him at his word, depending what happens maybe over this weekend, and that might affect how we approach the Cubs bullpen, at least at a minimum. And here's a surprise bit of news. Royce Lewis started his game with a home run, then he hit a single, then he left with an injury. We've got a lot of drafts going on this weekend. Royce Lewis has been going in the fourth-ish round lately. How much do you think this news affects his value, his draft value going into the weekend now that it's a bit more uncertain than it was yesterday?
I think it's worse than a random player, pulling up with a – I still haven't heard what it was. I think I heard it was a straight quad, but I haven't heard a timeline on him yet. But it's different than somebody else who you thought was – you know, durable, just having that random freak injury on opening day. I mean, this is the concern with Royce Lewis, right? It's funny, in our in our forums yesterday, somebody commented shortly before the Royce Lewis injury on an opening day thread. Somebody commented and said, how much did Mike Trout just help his value in drafts this weekend with his, you know, first home run of the season? And I said, well, we all knew that Trout could hit home runs. That wasn't the issue. But other than the fact that he got around the bases without getting hurt, I don't think we learned anything about his ability to stay in the lineup for 140 games. Then Lewis went out and proved my point by hitting a home run and then in his next at bat failing to get around the bases. So, you know, this is it was the embodiment of the total package of Royce Lewis, right? The talent is amazing and the ability to not stay healthy is equally amazing. I think that you knew last week that's what you were paying for if you bought him, and you still know that's what you're paying for if you buy him this weekend. The only difference is, you know, he's hurt for the first few weeks, so you got to price that out.
Todd,
you got to price that out. That's the people are looking for a reason to ignore these concerns. We can use Ronald Acuña. One great Superman season, and he's no longer subject to injuries. I mean, in a draft, you just have to return around $45 worth of value. He can be short 20 steals. He can miss 2 weeks and crush that still. In an auction, he was going $65, $70. You need to earn $65 or $70. It's a different scenario. So I think the thing with Lewis, we looked at, you know, let's prorate what he did when he was healthy last year. And we forget the fact that he's probably not going to be healthy. If nothing else, this should serve as a reminder for anybody that we pump up the draft board because of their potential. We kind of it masks this concern. It's a reminder. It's just another reminder that this is there. If you were drafting Lewis in the fourth round, you weren't factoring in that he could get hurt.
I thought that was ridiculous all winter. I totally agree.
Yeah, no, we both know that there are people. All right, we're very NFB centric, but there's people that believe they need to take chances and they need the upside. Then there's people that are in 10 drafts and this is my Royce Lewis draft. I've got FOMO. I'm of the mind, and you could put Ellie De La Cruz in this discussion, that if everybody did one draft, just one draft, some of these ADPs would not look the same.
I think that's accurate. And some of these people who are playing fantasy baseball now, 20, 25, 30 drafts, I see on Twitter and in their coverage of fantasy baseball at their various websites and podcasts. It's amazing to me that anybody can manage 30 teams, never mind draft them. But speaking of things that change, to the surprise of many fantasy managers, of course, the Orioles sent super prospect Jackson Holliday to the minors. They'll open the season with Gunnar Henderson here and Ramon Urias there and Jorge Mateo maybe stepping in, Jordan Westberg. They've got a lot of options in Baltimore, of course. So my first question, Todd, is how should fantasy managers who can acquire Holliday in their drafts this weekend be looking at him now that he's back on the farm? And in general, where are the opportunities?
Jackson Holliday did not, air quote, earn the demotion, right? I mean, offensively, defensively, for everything we saw, he deserved to be on the team. So why was he sent down? We don't know everything. Maybe the club wants him to work on some defense. Point being, to answer your question, I don't think he's going to be down for long. I don't know, but I don't think he's going to be down for very long. So if you're in a league where you can stash Holliday without hurting your roster maneuverability early on, in an auction, I'm not the guy that pays 18 units for a guy that I expect to come up because you just don't know. But I think you can accept the discount, and Holliday should be up. I don't know how soon, but maybe you guys can explain this because I keep reading about. At one point, I thought you had to be on the opening day roster to get the rookie compensation pick, but I think it's just if you're in the top 100, and he is obviously, and so just because he didn't break clamp with the team, if he comes up in 3 weeks and wins the Rookie of the Year, Holliday does. Baltimore can still be compensated. Is that right?
I think you had it right the first time. I think they have to be on the opening day roster.
See, I'll read that, then I'll read something else. And I think when the something else is the people didn't realize you had to be on the opening day roster. That's
yeah,
so I'm not sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I just read yesterday that the guys who signed the long-term contracts like Cole Keith and Jackson Churio are not eligible for that bonus if you sign before you make your major league debut. Like, I don't know. Would someone please just clarify this once and for all? That would be great.
So that means Yamamoto can't win it, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Like, we're rookie of the year. The Dodgers just won't get compensated.
The poor Dodgers. Yeah.
And after his first outing, it's going to have to take a big improvement for Yamamoto to even get votes. I think he had a single inning and 5 earned runs or something like that. But getting back to the question, when we look at these young players, there's going to be a risk anytime they're not on the roster. And even if they are, Wyatt Langford made the roster. All of a sudden, he started shooting up draft boards. And all he has to do is have a couple of lousy weeks or just not live up to expectations. And all of a sudden, I think the amount of rope that teams are willing to give these young players is less than they would veterans, of course. I think that's pretty much par for the course. And I believe that talent will out. And I think that this Jackson Holliday being sent down, if his draft position drops, I think it's a big opportunity for people to get him at a discount because he's going to be back sooner rather than later. I can't believe the Orioles are going to rely on Jorge Mateo and Ramon Urias.
No, I can't either. And in fact, you know, the other aspect of this is the ownership change in Baltimore. You never knew with the fail sons of the Angelos family what they were, how they were going to manage things. But I actually was watching that game yesterday since it was the first game that started, and they had the new owner David Rubenstein in the booth for the first couple innings, and he sounded more like a human being than I think almost a billionaire I've listened to, and is clearly just such a fanboy. Like, was, you know, this guy's a billionaire, he owns the team, and he was like pretty much losing his mind that he was sitting next to Jim Palmer, who was his childhood hero, right? It was like that sort of situation. So I you know, we'll see what happens, you know, as they manage that franchise going forward. But he seemed like, you know, the kind of owner who's going to be like, okay, we had to put Holliday in the minors for a couple of weeks. I get it. But, you know, the minute he makes this team better, I want him up here when we can, you know, once the rules allow it. So I would think we're going to see him before, I don't know, the end of April.
It has to be a baseball decision. I don't think it's a money decision anymore. He's just not turning to double play. Or I think they just want more reps at second base. That's my rationale. I don't know.
Lots of fantasy managers took later chances in the draft on unsigned DH-only J.D. Martinez, who has now signed with the Mets. He's going to start the year in the minors to get up to speed. But, Ray, how should drafters be looking at J.D. Martinez now that he has a team to call his own?
I thought he was overly discounted during his free agent period. I ended up snagging him in a draft like just last week, a couple of days before he signed with the Mets. And he was going in, you know, pass round 23 in a 15 teamer, which was you know, seemed very cheap, so that worked out for me. I think we'll see what happens. I mean, it sounds like JD is just in the minors until, it sounds like, next weekend. He's gonna miss the first 10 days or so of the season just working out his swing. But it's kind of funny to me, the juxtaposition of this, that Blake Snell, who you would think would actually need time to stretch out and that sort of thing, is gonna pitch in the majors before J.D. Martinez hits. But I think that's a reminder that J.D. Martinez is 36. J.D. Martinez has a history of back problems, and the you know, he needed a spring training to get his body in a condition to do his job, even though his job is just DHing. So he's a, you know, yes, he's going to be a nice addition to the Mets lineup, but yes, he's also a 36-year-old DH with a history of back problems. So let's see how he holds up over the course of the entire year. It's probably very prudent that they're handling him this way, but it's also a reminder that even though he's a DH, you can't just pencil him in for 140 days in a row at DH after he comes back from, I always fail at this game. Is it Syracuse for the Mets? I think it's Syracuse.
Yeah, and there's also the non-objective problem that the Mets are cursed with injuries.
And he still clogs your utility spot, so there are downsides.
Todd, what do you think of JD?
I think just anecdotally, he volunteered to go down. He's such a perfectionist. He doesn't, you know, Snell, he mentioned. I think that Martinez just wants to make sure his swing is there before he hits in the majors. What I liked about, you mentioned the rated discount and the utility spot, I don't think you are pot committed to using Martinez every week in your lineup where you drafted him. You should never manage your lineup based on where you draft a player. You should manage it based on who's going to help you the most. But the point being, where people drafted Martinez, it was so late, you probably have other better players. If the matchup doesn't look good, if you're worried about Citi Field, you've got somebody else where you drafted Martinez. You don't, you know, Ortiz, when you drafted Ortiz, or right now Ohtani, you're pretty much using him every week. You're committed to using him every week. I don't think that's the case where we're able to get JD, is that you can, you know, utility's not clogged. If he's the best guy for the week, he's in there.
The Yankees leadoff hitter DJ LeMahieu is going to start the year on the IL. He's got a bruised right foot. They expect him, they say, to miss, and I'm quoting here, at least the first seven games of the season. And I have to say that at least part kind of scares me. So, Todd, how should fantasy managers view news like this about DJ LeMahieu, himself an aged veteran?
Right. One of the things with LeMahieu was he's kind of off the radar, but there's a chance he leads off for the Yankees. Wow, I got to draft DJ LeMahieu now. If that was your rationale, that's kind of, to me, that's faulty thinking. All right, he leads off opening day. Who's to say LeMahieu continues to lead off? If there's a reason you weren't interested before, you should still not be interested in. The fact he may be hitting leadoff wasn't enough. But I think we knew this going in with LeMahieu, someone like him. I believe he's first and third. If he's not, you expect him to be. To me, that makes him like better qualified to be a fantasy corner than it does, I need a third baseman, I'm drafting LeMahieu. So, and again, you should have been expecting an injury, but the problem is, if you're hurt opening day, now you've got, whatever it might be, 140 more days to still get hurt, right? I mean, you know, if you're expecting to miss 20 games, all right, I missed the first 20, I'm safe. No, you can now miss more games. I'm kind of with you in that, you know, the at least part. When it's a bruise, I'm less concerned about it, at least, I guess. But now it's about, you know, how fast do a player heal from a bruise? And he's a little bit older, so it takes a little bit longer. But hopefully you had a built-in parachute plan B if LeMahieu was on your team. Now you just have to enact it a little bit earlier.
Right.
Yeah, and everything Todd said is true. On top of that, I don't actually think that Oswaldo Cabrera, who homered yesterday, is going to Wally Pip LeMahieu, but LeMahieu is not immune from losing his job if one of the Yankees' collection of prospects blossoms and pushes him for playing time. And then to Todd's point, I totally agree with him about the idea of overvaluing LeMahieu because you thought he was going to hit leadoff. There's always so much overvaluation of projected lineup positions. My canonical example of this goes back, it must be 15 years now, when Justin Upton came up in Arizona as a 20 or 21-year-old rookie, and he was batting eighth on opening day, and everyone was like, oh, he's batting eighth. I want nothing to do with that. That's going to be terrible. He batted eighth for 3 weeks until he slugged 700 and worked his way up to the cleanup spot. So these things are all fluid. The managers are trying to win games, and if LeMahieu is not back to the 2 or 3 year old version of DJ LeMahieu, the Yankees are going to find a different option to put in front of Soto and Judge than LeMahieu. It's not like he's got it in his contract and he gets to lead off in front of those guys and score 100 runs. That's not the way this works.
But managers can sometimes be pretty stubborn, and there's that kind of old-timey manager thing that you can't lose your job because you got hurt. So when he does come back, he probably goes straight back to the leadoff spot. But as you say, doesn't guarantee he keeps it. We've got something of a mess, guys, in the Cleveland outfield. They cut Miles Straw. They've got Stephen Kwan pretty much locked into left field, but then we've got Tyler Freeman, Ramon Laureano, Estevan Florial, and Will Brennan to slot into center right and maybe share some DH time. So where, if anywhere, are the fantasy opportunities in the Cleveland outfield, Todd?
You see, this is interesting because they did the right thing, right? And I think Oakland's doing the right thing with Esteban Urias not playing every day. For different reasons. Straw's good defensively. Ruiz is not. But you sort of, all right, are any of these guys mixed league worthy to sort of preface the conversation? And I don't know that they are. They may become more relevant when injuries start to, well, injuries are already setting in, Zola, but I don't know that these guys, you know, Tyler Freeman is the guy that's sort of most intriguing because he wasn't going to be playing in the infield, but it's still Tyler Freeman. Is it still mixed league worthy production if he's full time? I think it's more relevant in the AL only play leagues, where if you had Freeman as a minor leaguer and he's not going to play enough, well, now maybe he will. So that's sort of where in, did I cut Tyler Freeman off of a minor league roster already this year? Yeah, because I didn't know this at the time. But I think that, I don't know. I don't know that any of these guys are that important for mixed league yet. I think it becomes more important when you're looking for reserves. And you know what? We say it all the time. Now's the time to improve your reserve list. You're right. If I have no injuries, I don't have to put Fab in this week. No, if you can upgrade your reserves, now's the time to do it. Because when you're going to need that guy, the inventory is not going to be so good. So maybe you put Florio on your reserve, upgrading over, maybe you took a chance on Willy Abreu, and maybe that doesn't look like it's going to work out as well as it was a few weeks ago. Maybe Florio, or maybe you want Abreu for the upside. You have to decide what you want.
And the price certainly changes if all of a sudden everybody realizes that the player that you could get for a dollar now is available, yeah, and now he has a full-time role, and everybody says, now I'm going to bid 30 or 40 or whatever it turns out to be. Ray, where are you on this outfield situation?
You guys covered this nicely. I think the only other thing I'll chime in with when Todd talks about improving your reserves, despite David Fry's performance yesterday in the DH spot, despite Freeman looking like he belongs in center field, that's great. That's good news for Freeman. Maybe he sticks around. But I think it's just a reminder that the hitter who's better than all of these guys is the one who's not here yet, and that's Kyle Manzardo, who you got to believe that once the Guardians, I'm going to learn that this year, once the Guardians have played through all of these other options and looked at Fry and looked at Floreal and decided whether or not Freeman can stick in center field, once they play all of this out, they're going to make room for Manzardo sooner than later, I would think.
And I'll see your Manzardo and raise you a Chase DeLauder.
Absolutely.
This could become a very, we need more power. We need more run producers. No, you've got them. You just need them to get better and bring them up.
They're in Akron. Call them.
Yeah.
And finally, Jonathan Aranda of Tampa. A lot of people were interested in Aranda going into drafts earlier this year. He broke his right ring finger fielding a ground ball. Never a good sign for a guy who fields things and breaks his fingers doing it. He's going to miss 4 to 6 weeks. And the likeliest immediate beneficiary, of course, is DH Harold Ramirez, who is on the short side of a platoon with Aranda and now is going to see some added plate appearances versus right-handed pitching. And we should say that he's not a bum against right-handed pitching. He's not as good as he is against left-handed pitching, but I think his career OPS is in the 720 kind of range, which isn't, anybody that's going to make the Hall of Fame, but 720 is not bad. What should be our level of interest in Harold Ramirez now that Aranda's out, Ray?
You know, it's hard because, again, it goes back to Todd's point about the mixed league lens versus the AL-only lens. I think you have to be interested in Ramirez in AL-onlys because there's probably more than 50% playing time there now. But it's hard to say he's mixed league worthy because even if he's picking up more than 50% of the playing time, I think it's probably less than 65% of the playing time just because the Rays are going to Ray and, do their, what the Cubs used to call a team pretzel thing and, shuttle everybody in and out of the lineup. And, Ramirez is probably 4 days a week starter. And that's just really tough to make use of in a mixed league.
Todd.
Yeah. And I think we need to keep in mind with Ramirez is that not that having batting average as your main asset is a bad thing. In certain lineup constructs, it helps, but he's not filling up the stat sheet with either homers or stolen bases. So I don't know that I think any more or less of Ramirez than I did previously. in an AL only, you know, if you're drafting AL only, I think you take a little bit harder look at a guy like Austin Shenton at this point. He's not going to play much, but it's the Rays. He's going to play. You know, when you say, you know, Rays doing Rays, that, you know, or Cubs cubbing, you know, it's usually a bad thing. But with the Rays, that's a good thing. You know, it's a compliment. Right. You know, so you know, interesting. And, you know,
it's just frustrating for us, that's all.
Yeah, and we could do the same, you know, Kyle Manzardo, Chase DeLauder. There's Junior Caminero hanging out. What's he doing down on the farm? How soon will Caminero be up at the big club? So there's a lot of, you know, with the Rays, I love their guys for AL only just because you're paying for 100 bats and you get 300. Mixed league, there's only a precious few that you just trust are going to be in the lineup every day. And if you've got the maneuverability, okay, but to me, they take a bit of a hit in the mixed league.
Yeah, in those only league situations as well, you really are focusing intently on getting plate appearances. And if you're starting to gamble on these Rays guys, you kind of are adding a bit of an element of risk to your roster construction because you might pick up a guy thinking, oh, here's at least 450 plate appearances, and then it ends up being 150 for reasons having nothing to do with anything except that's how the Rays do things. Any other late news do you think we should mention, Todd, before we move on?
I mean, other than the fact that it was just such a shame to see Justin Steele go down the way he did, fielding a bunt on a very nice defensive play, I'm like, please be a cramp. Please be a cramp. Uh-oh, it's not a cramp. I think we kind of hit on it with the first segment is last year we didn't have to worry about managing closers because they didn't get hurt. They didn't lose jobs. We're already seeing it early this year. So, you know, there's always breaking stuff, but when the breaking stuff is hamstring and obliques, they get a look, you know, that's not good.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the Steele injury as well. It's interesting from the Cubs' perspective because we thought this rotation got so much deeper this winter, and that didn't even make it till April with Steele being out and Tyone being on the IL to start the year. So, you know, it's April. There are plenty of off days. The Cubs might be able to fake this for a couple of weeks with just the remaining Hendricks, Imanaga, and Wicks, and then some Drew Smyly or some bullpen days or whatever. But sooner or later, they're going to have to find another starter, and we'll have to wait and see whether Tyone or Steele can be back that quickly, or if they're going to have to go down to tap AAA for Cade Horton or something like that. So we may not get those answers immediately, but I would imagine that that's what the Cubs front office was talking about in the wee hours of this morning.
Ray, would you stash Cade Horton if your league rules allowed it?
You know, it always depends what the cost of the stash is. If you have enough bench guys or you're running a farm, absolutely. But, you know, back to Todd's point about being NFBC centric, if, you know, if you've got no IL and you know, in a single pool of bench spots that you're going to use to carry injured guys, etc., then I get a lot less interest in stashing guys like that because, as Todd was saying, you may not need those roster spots today. Maybe everyone's healthy, but if you go pick up Horton today, you're probably going to end up cutting him because you get three guys injured before he gets called up.
All right, then let's take a quick break. Ray, I want to ask you about the season opening profile of the new baseballhq.com and all the great content at the site. Then we'll come back with some boons and banes for 2024. Ray, what is on tap for subscribers to the site now that the regular season is underway?
Yes, we are in the process of rolling out our in-season tool set. You know, we were sort of in preseason mode in terms of what tools we had ready for the go live of the new site back in the beginning of February. But already this week, we've dropped our popular starting pitcher matchup tools, which got a new look and feel as well, and look you know, match the modern mobile friendly look of the website with our starting pitcher metrics there. We dropped my favorite new thing might be our new leading indicator charts, which were some static pre-filtered lists of batters, pitchers, relievers, et cetera, who meet certain skill criteria that should be interesting to you in your fab research, et cetera. Here are, you know, guys who could assume the closer role. Here are batters who deserve a better batting average than they're getting, you know, those sorts of things. But they were only, they were all static reports on the old website. But on the new site, we've got this cool table tool that allows you to, you know, just drop sliders on the site and say, okay, we're going to set it, set this filter for guys who have batting average rise potential, for set it for guys who have a contact rating, a contact of, you know, 60%. And then it's a slider. So you can move the slider from 70% to 80%. And the table just refreshes and shows you the guys who meet that filter. You can drag them around. You, you know, it's interactive. It's dynamic. It's, you know, 21st century web technology, PD, that we haven't had, that we haven't had on this site for, well, ever. So, you know, if I sound giddy about it, it's because, I'm pretty giddy about it, and there's more coming. We've got the we'll have our lineup tools up probably early next week, the latest. One thing people have noticed is missing is our injury feed data, but that's just a couple of days away too. So we're gonna have, and then next week, next Sunday, Ryan Bloomfield starts up his Market Pulse column with the, you know, in every Sunday fab roundup, that sort of thing. And he's got some tools that are always included in the ad about the coming week in terms of breaking down each team's schedule, who's facing more lefty starting pitchers, more righty starting pitchers, what are the aggregate ratings of the pitchers that each team is facing every week. That's a really popular report that we'll have ready in the next couple of days too. So, you know, we're throwing the switch into in-season mode. It's all coming quickly. We're writing site updates announcing this stuff, you know, pretty much every day. So it's super exciting. It's super busy, but we're meeting the demand of the season starting.
Are there adjustable filters for pitch types? I guess what I'm asking, is there a slider?
A slider. We may have to look at that. We don't have that. We don't have the pitch type data. My take on, in general, on looking at pitch types and pitch mix changes and stuff like that, is that it's interesting, but if that is changing a pitcher's profile, it's going to show up in the numbers we do have. You're going to see it in the strikeout rate. You're going to see it in the swing strike rate. You're going to see it in the first pitch strike rate, et cetera. If you see those things on our site and you see the metrics changing and you see, oh, this pitcher appears to be doing something different, then sure, go over to Baseball Savant, wherever you consume pitch type data, and get the confirmation of, oh, look, it looks like his swinging strike rate jumped in the last 6 weeks. And if I look at his pitch type mix, that correlates exactly with when the, when the release point on his slider changed. And now you have your confirmation that, there's something driving the data change. But the my sort of take on the whole thing is that you can still identify the improvements in the data that we have, even if you don't have the fact that he's throwing his slider twice as often at your fingertips on our site.
Well, there you have it. It's a very exciting time for baseballhq.com. The in-season tools are rolling out, and it's all available for you. Just go over and check it out at baseballhq.com.
Baseball HQ Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Baseball HQ Radio. Patrick Davitt here with our roundtable panelists. Todd Zola from Masters Ball, RotoWire, ESPN, SiriusXM, and Ray Murphy from baseballhq.com. Guys, let's do our fantasy look ahead for 2024. As far as the players are going, we'll do boons and banes in the tradition of Baseball HQ Radio. We're going to base these on draft rounds. So let's say when we talk about the early rounds, going to be rounds 1 to 3, 1 to 4 around there. Middle rounds, say 10 to 14. And the later rounds, 20 or later. These are not etched in stone. Take it whatever way you want to. I will say, again, in keeping with what we've been doing this year, we won't have any boons in the early rounds because they should all be boons, and we won't have any banes in the late rounds because most of them are going to be banes, as we realize. So let's start in the middle round for hitters. Todd, who do you think is a boon in those middle rounds among hitters?
In the first segment, we talked a little bit about spot in the batting order and how we really shouldn't be overly concerned about it. I think James Outman was penalized too much, but he's going to be hitting seventh. He's going to be hitting seventh for the Dodgers. that lineup's going to turn over. He's gonna produce, and maybe it was just in drafts and in auctions. Wow, I can get Outman cheaper than I have him priced for. I think Outman is the guy that I like from those rounds that could next year move up considerably.
Ray, who you got?
Homer bias a little bit, but I'm going to go with Trevor Story. I thought he was just way too discounted at the draft table based on the bad and injury riddled season he had last year. I still believe he can hit. We already saw last night he stole a base. I think he's going to run again. I think the power is going to come back. He was bad again to the lineup point that Todd makes. We're not going to overemphasize that. But he was hitting cleanup last night, and I think he's going to stay right around that spot. I think he can fill up the stat sheet in at least four categories. I don't think the BA will be a plus, but I think there's plenty of homers and stolen bases there, and I think that the screwed-up season he had last year after missing half the year and then not hitting when he came back and switching positions and all that stuff, I'm willing to give him a mulligan, and I think there's a lot more value there than the price.
It wasn't a good year for Trevor Story last year, but 10 stolen bases in 170 plate appearances is not nothing. If you multiply that out to 650, you're looking at close to 40 stolen bases at that pace, and that's certainly something that's real interesting in those middle rounds, as we said. My guy for this is going to be Dalton Varsho, the outfielder in Toronto. His career profile, as we know, kind of a strikeout-prone hitter with a low 229 career batting average, but he's had decent power. He's got 25 home run power and decent speed, you know, 17 to 20 stolen bases per 650 plate appearances. And his plate skills have actually been kind of league average, 23% strikeout, 7% walk. But this spring, you guys, I don't know if you noticed this, but he looks like a hitter with a completely revamped approach. He's got more walks than strikeouts in spring, 17% to 15%. He's got 3 points more on his hard hit rate and three less on medium hit, and he stole 8 bags during preseason without being caught. These seem to me, guys, like a bunch of signals that Varsho is tired of being an easy out. And the fly in the ointment with all of this is there's an 8-point decline in spring and fly balls, and he's improved his home run per fly ball rate, but his lone spring home run sounds a note of caution. But he plays a sterling outfield defense. He's going to play every day in Toronto. And at a 14th round ADP, I think he could finish this year well above that level. So let's go on to our late round boon hitters, and we'll start with Ray, who's a boon hitter in the later rounds.
This is another soft factor thing, but I'm willing to, I convinced myself as the offseason went on that once Tim Anderson signed in Miami, I was willing to give him a mulligan on last year too. To be clear, Miami's not a great place for a hitter to go who's trying to revive his bat. The park factors and the division, to the extent that matters, are not ideal, but I think Anderson's going to play a lot there. And I just don't believe he could be as bad as he was last year. You know, if you dive into the numbers, and we did this in the Baseball Forecaster, he actually got off to a really good start last year. I think he stole 5 bases in the first 10 games. And then I forget what the injury was. He got hit on the knee or banged up his knee or something. And the stolen bases dried up. And then the rest of the season just completely went off the rails there. There were some off-field issues that may or may not have complicated that. But he's not so old at, I think, 31 that we would write him off. So I'm looking for a rebound there. And it's another case, like we talked about with, you know, JD Martinez, where I think his lengthy free agency really dragged down his ADP, and then the ADP did not rise after the signing, maybe because it was Miami. The ADP did not rise the way I thought it would. But at this near free price, I was happy to take a shot at a Tim Anderson rebound.
And I remember looking into this a few years ago. Knee injuries have a sort of pernicious effect on batting average and power, because all the power in your swing comes from your legs. And if your knee is hurt and, you know, you have to adjust to try to take some of the pain away, it can really affect batting line drives and hitting the ball hard and all those kind of things, because you just can't generate enough torque. I had Victor Scott in this ADP range, but I think that ship sailed with the news that he's going to open the year for the Cardinals in center field. So I'm going to go with Detroit catcher Jake Rogers. He's going right at the end of this ADP range, and he makes a pretty good second catcher option for fantasy leagues that require one. He had 31 homers and 620 career plate appearances, so that's around 33 for a full season. He's not going to get a full season. He's a catcher, after all. Most projections say he's probably around the mid-300s plate appearances, which would be 18, 19 homers. And because he pulls the ball so much, maybe that's more a floor than a ceiling. And in a weird way, the reduced playing time by being a catcher might be a blessing, because his batting average is not going to be good. It'll be closer to 200, I think, than to 250. So fewer at-bats might actually improve your team's batting average, because he can't kill you so much hitting 200 with 500 at-bats. But anyway, 220 is not that different from a lot of other second catcher options, and most of them don't have Rogers' power. So that's my Jake Rogers is my guy in the late rounds. Todd, who do you got?
Just to your point about Rogers, you're talking fewer plate appearances. The report came out that he and Kelly could be rotating both in the lineup at the same time, with the other being DH. So now you're only going to do that if you're earning it. Well, I mean, you have to then be kind of commonsensical. It's only if he's earning it, which now is a good thing. But it's just something to keep in mind. I think this is where I'm contractually obligated to say Vaughn Grissom. But since I've been saying Vaughn Grissom all year long, I'm going to go with Bryce Turang in this area. And it has to do with a little bit the way I manage the teams, in that, especially in the middle, I look to have two choices. I look to have a speed option and a power option, depending on what I need for my middle infielder. And Turang is someone that kind of stands out as the speed option, the cheap speed option. And I squint and see batting average and power upside. By upside, I mean more than 210 and six homers that he hit last year. So I think that in the range you can get a Bryce Turang, I think you've got your luxury item for steals with the potential to be your middle infielder.
Some pretty interesting choices there. Let's go to the mound, and I'll lead us off on the middle round Boone pitchers. My pick is Boston right-hander Nick Pivetta. He somewhat notoriously started throwing a sweeper last season after he got kicked out of the Red Sox rotation. And then from June forward, and I know this is kind of a cherry-picking the stats to a certain extent, but from June forward, he dropped a 3.18 ERA, 0.98 whip, 35% strikeout rate, 8% walk rate. That's a 27% strikeout minus walk, and that's elite. There was some good luck involved, but also some bad on the strand rates and hit rates and home run per fly ball rate. And he was unlucky this spring, 16% home run per fly ball rate that contributed to a 5-plus ERA, but his spring whip was under 120, his FIP and XFIP around 4, and he still has that 24% strikeout minus walk rate. So I think Pivetta hinted at something better than 10th round value last June through October, and I'm willing to bet that he does likewise for this full season. Todd, who you got in those mid-round pitchers?
See, I wrote down Keller. I'm pretty sure I meant Mitch and not Brad. So I'm going to go with Mitch. You know, I mean, if we're talking deep, I don't mind Brad Keller deep, but Mitch Keller is a good whip away from being a better pitcher. Strikeouts are there. Team context, all right, isn't great as far as wins go with Pittsburgh. But the walk rate's kind of already under control. I think there was some BABIP. I think there's some BABIP correction coming. And if Brad Keller gets the whip in, you know, that helps ERA. I just like what I see. I like the contract. All right. Some people are going to argue that's a bad thing. He doesn't try anymore. I don't believe that's going to be the case. I think Brad Keller, if the question is sort of which guy can move into the next tier, I think it's Mitch Keller.
Ray, who you got for a late round Boone pitcher?
I'm going to throw Hunter Brown onto the pile here, and I really like the tier. I was cleaning up in all my drafts this year.
Oh, yeah.
Hunter Brown and Pivetta, and it was Wu and Bryce Miller, and you know, so many other guys who were, you know, in that round 10 to 15 range. But let me talk about Brown for a minute. And as much as I like the skills, I think the team context around him is set up perfectly for him. First of all, they're committed to him with the injuries to Verlander or Keady, et cetera. There's no risk of him being removed from the rotation. He comes in with a platform year of 155 innings last year in the majors. So he's not one of these guys who were excited about him, but like Bobby Miller or, you know, any of those other guys who, you know, were not in his, Miller's not in the same tier, but this is not a case where we're just hoping for 140 good innings because that's all he'll get. Brown is fully platformed up to take a run at like 180 this year. And then obviously it's a good team, good lineup behind him. But then there's that bullpen, which I think is also optimally set up for him, especially if you happen to be in a quality starts league, because they have that Abreu, Presley, Hader back end to close out the wins for him. But they also have nobody you've ever heard of in front of those three guys. So it's not like they can pull them after, you know, they can't make them a five and fly guy and, you know, expect their bullpen to just close it out from there, because the middle relief is really, really suspect there. So I think it's entirely likely you're going to see Brown trying to, you know, they're going to try to get him to go six and a third, give the ball right to the three guys at the end. Not that all three of them are going to pitch every day, but you know what I mean. And I think it sets up really well for Brown to not only display the good skills to have us excited about him, but also rack up a fair bit of volume here, which I think only enhances his value.
My late round Boone pitcher, I'm starting to feel like a bit of a Red Sox fanboy. Might not be the greatest thing this panel needs, but I really like Tanner Houck. He wasn't good last season, ERA over 5, WHIP 130 or so. But he was making the jump from 4 spot starts in 2022 to 21 starts in 2023, 60 innings to 106 innings. Baseball HQ is projecting 116 innings, I think, this year. Most other projection systems say about 130, so there's a bit of innings upside. There's some question about what he can do against lefty hitters. He's got a 253, 343, 420 career slash, but I've read in a couple of places that this spring he's been throwing a cutter more and more effectively to try to address that shortcoming against left-handed hitters. He's at 240, 087 this spring, big gains in strikeout minus walk and swinging strike. It's just 15 innings, I understand, and there's lots of questions, so you got to be ready to pull the plug early, but a late-round pick like this is basically free, so I think it's all upside for Tanner Houck. Let's go over to our Baines, and we'll start at the top this time, the top rounds, Bane hitters. Ray, start us off.
I apologize, because as I'm sitting here looking at this, we may have had this conversation already, but my early-round Bane is Marcus Semien, just because the value comes so much from the high playing time and law of averages plus age suggest that I don't know that we could pencil in another 700 plate appearances, even though he's done that for however many years running, and the skills may not just be good enough to return the same value if it's 600 plate appearances instead of 700. So I was off of Semien all spring for that reason, and I stand by it. If he shoves another 700 plate appearances at me, more power to him. I'll probably be in exactly the same place this time next year.
Well, because it'll be another year older. He's 33
exactly. Another
now.
Year older. I was right. I was just a year early. You see, this is why it's a brilliant argument. Eventually, I'm going to win.
Just keep saying it until he's 60.
This is the year. I'll be banging this drum.
Well, much as it pains me as a Reds fan, I'm going to join the very large number of Baseball HQ guests this spring who have taken Ellie De La Cruz as a Bane. Also, that was when his ADP was in the third round. Now he's well up into the second. I understand the appeal. 35 stolen bases and 427 plate appearances last year is a 50-plus season for a full season, and a full season looks increasingly likely with all of the injuries in Cincinnati. But I look at his 34% hit rate, which might come down, and his batting average is already low enough. 34% strikeouts, fifth highest in baseball last year among players with 400-plus plate appearances, and it's even higher in the spring this year. And I prorate his 2023 counting stats, so I see a 650 plate appearance guy with 100 runs scored and 50 or so bags. That's good, but otherwise, 19 homers, 65 RBIs, and a 225, 230 BA. I can't devote a second or third round pick on what might very well be a two-trick pony. I know it's an entertaining pony. It's a very exciting pony. But when I'm picking a second rounder, I'm looking for a thoroughbred. Todd?
I'm kind of surprised you guys left me C.J. Abrams. I assumed he'd be off the board. Now, but he can steal 50 bases, Ola. He could also steal 20. And you know, I think we have to draft Abrams. He needs that 40 or 45 to warrant whatever the fourth round pick at this point. And I think that's a little early, even in today's environment, to have such a question mark to be getting your steals. You're not drafting him for power. You're not drafting him for anything else. You're drafting Abrams because he ran a lot, and that's great. And he may run even more, but we don't know for sure. So where you have to draft Abrams, I'm willing to be wrong. You know, if you draft him and he gets 55 steals and you beat me, I'll shake your hand. But, you know, just shake mine when he gets 20.
I'm going to dive into that for a second. I'm completely the other end on Abrams. I'm not that worried about the four at all. Why are you worried that it's only 20 stolen bases?
Because he had the big jump in a year where everybody was. I don't know that we can say it for sure. I think there's enough risk with stolen bases in general, and it's more about the price has just gone to me. So high. Maybe it's because in that round I'm looking for pitching or something else, and I can't take the stolen bases there. I think there's enough risk where he's going. I mean, am I projecting 40? Yeah, I am. But when I'm at the draft table, it's like, and I hate when you're asked to hate when I'm. How much do you trust that projection? I don't punch anybody, but if I did, I would. It's my projection. I trust it implicitly. But I think there's enough risk that I would rather not put my eggs in the stolen base basket at that point. Do I think he's going to steal 35 or 40? Yeah. But I think there's enough risk doing 1 year. And the hit tool isn't that great to absolutely guarantee. I mean, you could have asked me this about Myles Straw a couple of years. Well, maybe that's not the best example.
Oh,
but,
how dare you.
I think we've seen examples of where stolen bases, it's not just skill. There's a want to. I'm not saying he doesn't want to, but there's more factors involved with stolen bases that put a bigger error bar around it.
I'll lead off our mid-round Bane hitters. With the perennial fantasy disappointment Byron Buxton of Minnesota still going in the rounds 13 or 14 or so, and still the massive injury risk he's been pretty much ever since he came into the league, he started his major league career on the DL, a wrist injury during spring training that year. He peaked at 140 games in 2017, and in the six seasons since then, the Twins have played 1,100 games, a little more, and Buxton has suited up for 392 of them. That's just barely a third of Minnesota's games have featured Byron Buxton. And based on his career record, I know if we could guarantee 650 plate appearances, Buxton would definitely be going higher. 30 homers, mid-70s RBIs, mid-90 runs, and probably 20-plus stolen bases, although his last two seasons have been well short of that. And the .230 batting average is no prize either. So I know it's the 14th round, but in the 14th round, I'll take Michael Garcia or Dalton Varsho, Edward Julian, Brandon Drury, somebody like that in that range. Todd?
I'm going to take Vinny Pasquantino, or I'm not going to take Vinny Pasquantino, as I should say. The injury shoulder, sapping some potential power. And power was the concern with Pasquantino previously. A great hitter, gap-to-gap hitter. But Kauffman Stadium is going to be good for his average. But we're not going to get the power that people think or people want to get when they choose Pasquantino. I think he hit an early home run. I think that was his only home run in the spring. So it's you can't even say, well, it looks like he's showing some power, so we don't have to worry about it. I think, you know, he lost last season's of development to see if we were going to get more power. We still may. We just don't know. And I think he's being drafted on the come a little bit still. I think there's still some prospect pedigree. He's a cool name with a cool nickname sort of guy that I'm not interested in where he's going.
What's that cool nickname again?
Breakfast? I think we can get canceled if we at this point. So yeah. I, I'll I will pass.
Italian breakfast. Isn't that it?
Something like that, yeah.
Wasn't Billy Butler some kind of breakfast back in the day? Country breakfast or something? I don't know. Maybe they just like their first base breakfast in Kansas City. I don't know. Ray, who's your Bane?
I'll go with Cedric Mullins. I think, you know, we touched on the Orioles with Jackson Holliday a little bit earlier, and we didn't really talk about the outfield, but I think the same dynamic applies in the outfield as the infield. They have so many guys coming who they need to figure out how to play, and the price on Mullins assumes he's still the everyday center fielder. I don't think he is. I think he gets platooned at minimum. So I think his upside is 500 plate appearances, whereas so much of his reputation, his historical value is based on 2021 and 2022, when he was one of those guys like Semien who was pushing 700 plate appearances, and the casual observer might look at last year and see that he missed some time with a groin strain and think that that's why the plate appearances dropped down under 500. But that's not the only reason. The platoon risk is real here, and I think he's overvalued or overpriced by the ADPs for being an everyday player when I don't think he's going to be.
Stolen bases on a ratio basis went down quite a bit too. He was sort of in the 30s in 2021 and 22 and fell to 19 last year, and his plate appearances didn't fall off quite that much. Let's go back to the mound, our early round Bane pitchers. Todd, who do you got?
So this is a little interesting to me in that, all right, the NFBC loves its strikeouts and pays for strikeouts, and the non-strike Logan Webb, Aaron Nola, they fall, but yet George Kirby, who doesn't strike a bunch of guys out, is kind of a darling this year, and he's the kind of guy that I hope to get because the NFBC doesn't like him, but for whatever reason he's the no walks, the Seattle, he's being drafted in that strikeout range, and I don't know that he's going to give him. I don't really see a Bane in this. I think the ADP was pretty good this year about pricing. So I mean, for you know where the player is purchased, it was kind of hard, you know, relative to their draft cost. But I don't think Kirby's going to give the strikeouts that people need for where he was being drafted. Now, all right, the ratios are so good, you can draft Mitch Keller later and make it up, but answering the question, I don't know how teams are going to construct their rosters. Kirby, to me, is a little bit pushed up without getting the strikeouts to warrant that high a pick.
He had 190 innings and 170 strikeouts last year, something like that. Is there any chance he could go all Rick Porcello and get, you know, more innings and get more strikeouts just on volume?
When you're at 190, there's not a whole lot of, there's more downward movement than upward movement. Yes. Maybe we need someone to, we need Nick Pollock or Eno Saris to, or, you know, someone on the HQ staff to show me where the strikeout upside is that I'm missing. Kirby is pound the zone, all Seattle pitchers pound the zone. They're just allergic to walks. Maybe there's something with the pitch mix or introducing a new pitch, and they were expecting the strikeouts to go up. I like George Kirby. I've got him ranked high. It's surprising to me that he was one of the pitchers that zoomed up the ADP without that strikeout rate that usually takes to have that happen.
And the other thing about 190 innings, if his ERA is 3.30 again and his whip's around 1, that's a real help to your overall decimals in your team, that's for sure as well. Ray, who you got for an early round Bane pitcher?
I was pretty consistent with this one all preseason too. For me, it's Tyler Glass now. I just can't get past the injury track record, the lack of volume. The 120 innings last year was a career high. Yay, he got through the season. You know, he started the season late, coming back from the Tommy John surgery, made 21 starts, the 120 innings. But if you look at the rest of his track record, he only had one other season back in 2018 when he was even over 100. I mean, his workloads are traditionally, you know, if you scan his historical tab and player link like I'm doing right now, he looks like a reliever, and he's getting drafted in the second round like everyone just assumes the Dodgers are going to magically, you know, pour the elixir down his throat to keep him healthy. You know, the Rays are pretty smart too, and they moved on here and didn't want to make the investment. I, you know, as Todd said, you know, certain markets love their strikeouts, and Glasnow gives those in spades. But I, there's just way too much volume risk here for the for what he costs for me.
I also had Tyler Glasnow for all of those same reasons, and just one thing. I also wonder about the fact that Tampa traded him away, which usually works out for them and for fantasy managers who bet against the pitcher that Tampa trades. And I know we have the feeling that Los Angeles is really good for pitching, but I don't know about the magic elixir preventing injuries. When I think of Los Angeles pitching, all I think about is injuries. It's like they're always injured. And their solution seems to have been we'll have nine starters on the roster at any one time, five of whom will be on the DL. And we'll just go forward from there because they can afford it with their $700 million payroll or whatever it is. And eventually Ohtani coming back and pitching maybe in the future. I don't know. I like the idea that Glasnow is not a good bet because he got traded away from Tampa. I think they're better at it than everybody else. And we'll wrap it up with our mid-round pitcher, Baines. Ray, kick us off.
We'll talk about Alex Lang in Detroit a little bit. You know, he didn't get the first save yesterday, which is a little bit of a surprise. I think my overall concern there is that maybe he's a victim of the mindset shift in Detroit that they're ready to win and they're ready to contend in that division. And they might be a little less patient with Lang's periodic bumps in the road as they come. There are other good options in that bullpen. And basically AJ Hinch might be a little bit less of a set it and forget it reliever. This is not even an indictment on Lang's skills, just that Hinch may be more opportunistic and may more manage his bullpen in the traditional way a contender does, and spread the saves out a little bit more. Work, you know, they might have more save ops. They might, you know, be using their better relievers more often. They might want to use Lang as a fireman in some spots. So, you know, it's not like Lang was being priced as one of the top end closers, but I think there's risk there from a number of other guys in that bullpen.
Boy, if you're using Alex Lang as your fireman with all those walks, you know, I talked with Doug.
Central. Everything else is, you know, everything's up for grabs.
I talked with Doug about the Detroit bullpen, and he says the guy with the skills in there is Alex Faedo. And sometime down the road, he's pretty sure that he's going to take up a more high leverage role. For me, I'll take, or to quote Todd, I won't take Walker Buehler, a round 14 starter who didn't play at all last year because of a second Tommy John surgery. And that was coming out of a fairly pedestrian 2022 season. The most important factor here is playing time. I know that Buehler won't start the season on the active roster. Supposedly he's rehabbing any day now. I don't know. The team, the media, the Buehler himself have all said the Dodgers want him ready for the playoffs. And if that's the case, that seems to me like they're going to baby him along during the season, which means even fewer starts possibly. And the pitchers going in this range, Nestor Cortes, Brian Bayo, Christopher Sanchez, Brandon Pfaadt, Aaron Civale, Tristan McKenzie even, I'll take any of them over Walker Buehler just because of that injury risk. Todd, who you got?
I've got Hunter Green. And you know, I talked strikeouts earlier. Hunter Green, where he's being drafted, you know, you can manage him. Maybe you don't want him in a lot, but expect him to be in the lineup, your fantasy lineup every week. But with Cincinnati as your home park, you're further restricted as far as when you can be in your lineup. You can't stream him at home because where home is. And he's also kind of two skills away, walking, control and command, which are different. And HQ knows it, but not everybody does. They're not interchangeable. Control is the high walks. Command is the high home runs. And he's guilty of both of them right now. The strikeouts come at too much of a cost for me to invest in Hunter Green where he's going. If you think he's going to fix one or the other, and the home runs fix themselves sometimes, okay. But right now he's got both issues, walks and home runs. And I'm not comfortable streaming him with the great American ballpark as his background.
Great Boons and Baines, guys. I appreciate you doing that work to sort those out. But one last question before we go. Who do you think, this can be a bold prediction or just something you think, but who's going to be the one fantasy player who has the greatest impact on the 2024 fantasy baseball season? And I'm going to go first, and this is someplace that Todd and I certainly disagree, because I think it's possible that Washington shortstop C.J. Abrams is going to be the most valuable player in fantasy baseball this year. His Baseball HQ projection is 15 homers and 53 stolen bases in around 650 plate appearances, a .250 batting average. The Nationals have attempted the second most steals this spring, and we have research that suggests team stolen base attempts in spring are very strongly correlated with what goes on in the regular season. Manager Dave Martinez has always been ahead of league average in steal attempts, and with a guy like Abrams, a 90% stolen base success rate, I think we better look out for a big stolen base score for him this year. So you heard it here first. C.J. Abrams hits 20-plus home runs, scores 100 runs, bats .260, and leads the majors with 90 to 100 stolen bases. MVP, MVP. Todd, who you got? And I know it's not C.J. Abrams.
No, it's not. I'm not a prospect guy. I don't know how great this comp is. But I look at Evan Turner and I see Corbin Carroll. I think Carroll had a higher prospect pedigree. But I see Turner putting up similar numbers at a much lower price. And we could subjectively, however we want to answer this question. I think at the end of the season, when we're talking about MVP as far as who produced more fantasy numbers than what was expected, I think it might be Turner. Carter.
Hey, who are we talking about?
Yeah.
Evan Carter.
It's Evan Carter.
I kept saying Turner. Evan, you guys got me. I mean, I know I volunteered to do it this early. When I used to do pods with DVR, he'd call it the Grumpy Todd. Yeah, this is just earlier than I'm normally up. And Evan Carter, don't tweet me. I'm sorry.
Ray, who you got?
I'm going to say that we're going to see for the first time in several years the fully healthy and vintage Mike Trout.
And if so, what do you think is a 90th percentile projection?
I mean, I don't think the stolen bases are coming back. Maybe we get 7 or 8 of those from him, but he could hit 300 with 40 plus home runs. We know he can still hit. And if he stays in the lineup, 340 and 100, that's Mike Trout returns to the first round.
And he, without Ohtani there, he's going to DH a little more.
Yep. Yep.
And Ron Washington wants him to run. So he may get 10 steals, not 8.
Oh, hey, 10, 10 would be great. Even better.
Yeah. Ron Washington says he wants the team to run. I went to look at the team. It's like, who? Joe O'Dell.
Team that can run, and this is not that team.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to make a Olympic 4x4 100 relay out of Kyle Schwarber and guys like that. Boy, guys, this has been great. Very interesting, as expected. Todd, tell our listeners where they can keep up with your work.
They can keep up with my work at, you meant Masters Ball. Behind the paywall, sorry, but I'm on Twitter. But you can hear me. I'm the Weekend Warrior at SiriusXM Friday, Saturday show with Eric Halterman from 1 to 3 p.m. ET. Sunday, I'm with Jeff Erickson. And I'm also on Saturday with Eric again on MLB Network Radio. So that's the best place to at least hear me mispronounce and misstate names. I'm also doing work with ESPN, a little bit different this year with our daily notes. I'm handling again the weekend. And so if you help you set your lineups, my notes will be showing up Saturday, Sunday, and Monday.
Ray, what are you up to?
Running Baseball HQ, PD. Brent and I have our opening day diary up on the site today. I'm actually going to be writing the double dip in starting pitcher column most of the season. So that'll be up on the site most Sunday mornings, and pinch hitting here and there with other features as the season goes on. So, never far away from the homepage of Baseball HQ.
And let's not forget, every week, every Friday, Ray Murphy,
right,
the news here at Baseball HQ Radio. All right, guys, that's a wrap. Todd Zola, thanks as always for helping us out, and we'll talk again during the season, I'm sure.
Yep, you know where to find me, my friend.
More importantly, I know when to find you, and it's not 8 o'clock in the morning. Ray, thanks as well, and I guess I'll be talking with you every Friday with your weekly news updates and on other occasions as well.
Sounds great, PD. Catch you next week.
Todd Zola writes for MastersBall, ESPN, and RotoWire, and appears regularly on SiriusXM. Ray Murphy is the co-general manager, projections manager, analyst, and writer at BaseballHQ.com. Our Baseball HQ commentaries are coming up. The Minor League Minute, Frequent Flyer, and my Extra Innings comment are right around the corner on the show. But before we get there, you heard Ray talking about some of the great tools debuting this week as the regular season starts. But we still have all that great content that lets us say BaseballHQ.com is the best fantasy baseball website in the business. In Playing Time Tomorrow roster forecasting, analyst Brian Rudd looks at the five teams in the American League Central, including the White Sox bullpen, the Detroit catching situation, and an eerily appropriate review of the Twins infield, mentioning a possible replacement in the extremely unlikely event that Royce Lewis gets hurt. In the daily pitcher matchups report for Friday, analyst Brian Entrekin looks at the slate and identifies the top starter matchups as Joe Musgrove of San Diego at home to San Francisco and George Kirby of Seattle at home to Boston. He also takes in a couple of not-so-good matchups, Martin Perez of Pittsburgh visiting Miami and Cal Quantrill of Colorado in Phoenix to take on the Diamondbacks. And in Playing Time Today, our crack team analysts look at stories including Miguel Sano bringing a familiar face but an unfamiliar physique to the Angels, and Phil Hertz reports on a major injury to Washington third baseman Nick Senzel and what the Nationals are doing about it. Playing Time Tomorrow roster forecasting, daily pitcher matchups, and Playing Time Today, three of the many great resources available when you subscribe to BaseballHQ.com.
Baseball HQ Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Baseball HQ Radio. I'm Patrick Davitt. Time now for our Baseball HQ commentaries. Coming up, we have the Frequent Flyer and my Extra Innings comment. And leading off, it's the Minor League Minute. And here with his final spring training report is Baseball HQ scouting team member Rob Gordon.
As we kick off the 2024 regular season and head into a busy draft weekend, the Minor League Minute takes a rapid-fire look at spring training position battles involving some of the top prospects in the game. And after that, we'll turn our attention to some players who did not make an opening day roster, but who could still be up by early May if not sooner. In Detroit, Colt Keith, despite a less-than-stellar spring, nailed down the starting second base role and should get plenty of runway after signing a 6-year, $28 million extension. The same is true in Milwaukee with outfielder Jackson Churio, who signed an 8-year, $82 million extension. After initially being sent down, the Cardinals' Victor Scott II will be the Cardinals' opening day center fielder after Dylan Carlson once again landed on the IL. Scott doesn't have much pop yet, but he did swipe 94 bases in the minors last year. He most likely heads back to AA Springfield, but a quick start, pun intended, could extend his stay in St. Louis. In Texas, Wyatt Langford forced his way onto the Rangers' opening day roster and will split time in the outfield and at DH. I've been bullish on Langford since I first saw him play at the University of Florida, and it's nice to get one right once in a while. Langford's teammate Evan Carter somehow doesn't seem like a rookie anymore, and his role in 2024 was never in doubt after an impressive postseason last year. The Padres' Jackson Merrill won the starting role in San Diego after moving from shortstop to center field, and he's been very impressive this spring. In Tampa, injuries created an opening for third baseman Curtis Meade, who looks like he will get at least semi-regular at-bats to start the year. In Chicago, both Jordan Wicks and Javier Assad will start the year in the Cubs' rotation, but only one is likely to stick there once Jameson Taillon comes off the IL. In San Francisco, injuries pretty much assured that Kyle Harrison would be in the Giants' starting rotation, and a solid spring has him opening the year as the club's number four starter. And in Boston, the uber-athletic Seydon Rafaela made the Red Sox opening day roster and will see plenty of action both in the infield and the outfield. So that's the good news. On the flip side, several high-profile prospects will either start the year in the minors or on the IL. In a surprise move, the Orioles opted to start Jackson Holliday at AAA, but for those who can draft and hold or who have a hefty FAB budget, Holliday makes an excellent target and should still be considered a possible Rookie of the Year candidate. Not surprisingly, the Tigers' Jackson Jobe and the Pirates' Paul Skeens were told early on that they would start the year in the minors, but what we did see of them only reinforced that these are the top two pitching prospects in the minors, and based on talent alone, both should be up at some point in 2024, with Skeens being a possible early May call-up. The Nationals' James Wood hit 364 with a 1,200 OPS this spring, but the rebuilding Nationals will have the 20-year-old outfielder start the year at AAA. Finally, with some bad news, the Diamondbacks' Jordan Lawler had surgery on his right thumb on Wednesday and will miss 8 to 10 weeks of action and might not make it back to the majors until mid-season, and he's starting to get the tag of being injury-prone. With this in mind, good luck drafting this weekend, and hopefully the start of the season goes well. And next week, we'll be back with more minor league news and notes. For Baseball HQ Radio, this is Baseball HQ minor league analyst Rob Gordon.
Baseball HQ scouting team member Rob Gordon has his minor league minute report regularly here at Baseball HQ Radio. Now it's time for the Frequent Flyer, where we look at a player who might be available this weekend in your draft or on your league's free agent list once the season starts, and who has the skills to contribute to the success of your teams. And here, with a look at Boston's shortstop outfielder Sidan Rafaela, is Baseball HQ analyst Alex Becky.
He's a toolsy, versatile prospect who may be the best defender in the minors, according to Jeremy Deloney's Boston Red Sox org report on BaseballHQ.com. Sounds good so far, but can he hit? Maybe that's the million-dollar question, 2024. According to Jeremy, toolsy 23-year-old Boston Red Sox defender, Sidan Rafaela finished fourth in the Red Sox minor league organization in home runs with 20 in 2023, en route to his 28-game Fenway audition last August. More specifically, Rafaela batted 302 with 20 home runs and 36 steals through two levels of the minors in 2023. However, Rafaela has an uber-aggressive approach and hasn't seen a pitch he wouldn't swing at, according to the March 28th Thrive or Dive edition of The Eyes Have It on BaseballHQ.com. That's why 23-year-old versatile Bo Sox outfielder Sidan Rafaela, like all of our frequent flyers, should be considered to be a long shot who may be worth an uber-aggressive flyer if he is still available in your league. But the buzz keeps growing in Beantown. However, expectations should be tempered for Rafaela, who only has 28 games of big league experience, according to Nesson's Adam London on March 24th. But Cora and company clearly see great potential in the Curaçao native, and he's in line to play an important role for the Red Sox this season, London added. Rafaela will play a Bradley-esque center field, predicted the Boston Globe's Chad Finn on March 26th, referring to Jackie Bradley Jr., JBJ. CBS Boston's Matt Geegan showcased Rafaela's dazzling glove and solid bat on March 26, declaring that Rafaela's potential is through the roof, further venturing that Rafaela could develop into something special this season. Scouts rave about his range, his arm, his daring, quoting NBC Boston's John Tomasi on February 16th. He was a human highlight film in the minor leagues, electrifying, according to NBC Boston. And he could be a dynamo in multiple scoring categories, according to Baseball HQ's Jeremy Deloney, adding that Rafaela has stolen at least 23 bases in each season as a pro, and he also hit 20 home runs in 2023. He could be a unique fantasy talent if he's eligible at both outfield and shortstop, again quoting Jeremy. Lots to sort out here, but it's beginning to look like Rafaela is Boston's best answer at center field or second base, referencing the March 14th edition of Playing Time Today on BaseballHQ.com. Meaning that uniquely talented Boston Red Sox outfielder, Sidan Rafaela might also be your best answer as our frequent flyer for this week. For Baseball HQ Radio, I'm Alex Becky of BaseballHQ.com.
Baseball HQ analyst Alex Becky has his frequent flyer comment here on Baseball HQ Radio every week. Now it's time for Extra Innings, my weekly comment on baseball and fantasy baseball. And this week, I want to talk about whether two fantasy managers can use the Doug Dennis no-starter strategy in the same league without sinking both teams.
Earlier this week, I had Doug Dennis on the show, and we discussed his tout American League strategy of drafting no starting pitchers, plenty of Lima relievers and a couple of closers, and a big offense. Doug mentioned there's no way two teams could try the same strategy because they'd basically cancel each other out. It's a sentiment I've heard elsewhere as well. The thing is, I've thought more about it, and now I'm not sure that analysis is right. I think two teams could adopt the strategy and not necessarily be involved in a negative-sum game of mutually assured destruction. To start, let's review Doug's roster. He ended up with two seemingly full-time closers in Juan Duran and Peter Fairbanks for a total of $41. He got a tenuous closer in Will Smith of Kansas City, three handcuffs in John Schreiber and James MacArthur of Kansas City and Jason Adam of Tampa to back up Fairbanks for $13 total. He also got a semi-handcuff in Minnesota, Justin Topa, for a buck, and a saves candidate in Prelander Baroa of the White Sox for two. He also got injured superstar starter Jacob deGrom for $2 as a future trade chip. Doug has since disabled or reserved Baroa, Duran, Topa, and deGrom, and picked up free agent Lima relievers Alex Fado and Will Vest of Detroit and Josh Winkowski of Boston. Doug also spent nearly $200 on his offense, focusing on high on-base percentage guys and big plate appearance guys. The theory, of course, is that he'll punt wins and strikeout categories, but sweep the offensive categories. He got 59 of the 60 points last season, and he'll sweep the pitching ratio categories with all those Lima relievers, the theory goes, and saves with his two closers and several proto-closers. Now, if someone else mimicked this approach, the theory goes, they'd necessarily divide up the spoils and both teams would finish middle of the pack or worse. But why? Just looking across the tout AL auction, another manager could have assembled a very similar pitching staff to Doug's. All these salaries were taken from the actual tout auction. An elite closer, Emmanuel Clase, for 23, a capable second closer like Clay Holmes for 19, a questionable closer in Jose Leclerc for 9 with his handcuffs David Robertson for 3 and Josh Sabores for 1, and then a few next-in-line Lima guys like Robert Stevenson for 3 and Griffin Jacks, Yimi Garcia, and Chris Martin all for 1, and Josh Sabores and Garcia were actually reserve picks. The total for that staff, a Doug pitching staff, $61, $3 less than Doug spent. Now, since we assume that the non-Doug competitor is as adept at drafting hitting as Doug is, by no means a sure thing, Doug's pretty good, let's assume that the competitor gets a similar amount of projected offensive production as Doug gets. Why are both teams now going to plummet in the standings? Doug's aim is to sweep the 8 non-starting pitcher categories, so let's say these two teams split those categories, 4 12-pointers apiece, 4 11-pointers apiece. It seems pretty likely that the non-12-point team in each case will be the 11-point team, right? So instead of Doug getting 96 points across those categories, he gets 92. 4 categories times 12 points is 48 points, 11 points times the other 4 categories is 44 for a total of 92. Now, as it happens, Doug got 90 points last season. He got 11 in stolen bases and ERA and just 6 in whip. But let's stick with the 12-11 divides across these non-starting pitcher categories. Now, Doug and his mirror competitor both have 92, and each of them has either 1 point or 2 in strikeouts and wins by default. The team last year with the 2 points in strikeouts was 300 ahead of Doug, and the team with 2 in wins was 17 ahead. So the three outcomes are, Doug gets 96, the other team gets 92, or the reverse, or a 93-93 tie. So far from being a huge points loss that dooms both teams, it's going to be a very close race that will probably be decided by in-season roster management and a healthy dollop of luck. So if someone this weekend in your league is doing a Doug and you want to try it, go right ahead. If you're one of two such teams, your chances of winning are probably higher than if you just go along with the usual roster build of everybody else. That's where your disasters happen. Now, why didn't I think of this 2 weeks ago? For Baseball HQ Radio, I'm Patrick Davitt of BaseballHQ.com. I have my extra innings commentary here on Baseball HQ Radio as often as I can. And that's Baseball HQ Radio for Friday, March the 29th.
Thanks very much for taking the time to download and listen to show number 10 of the 2024 fantasy baseball season. I also want to thank our guest experts for this Friday roundtable edition, Ray Murphy, the co-general manager, projections manager, analyst, and writer at baseballhq.com, and Todd Zola from Masters Ball, ESPN, RotoWire, and SiriusXM. As I said in the intros, Todd is a longtime favorite guest here at Baseball HQ Radio, and Ray is a foundational person in the success of this podcast, both as our news analyst and behind the scenes. It's always great fun and very insightful to have these two industry giants on our podcast together. I also want to thank our regular commentators from BaseballHQ.com, the best fantasy baseball website in the business. Our Minor League Minute commentator was Baseball HQ scouting team member Rob Gordon, and our frequent flyer commentator was Baseball HQ analyst Alex Becky. I'm Patrick Davitt, your extra innings commentator and the host of Baseball HQ Radio. I sure hope to see you on those BaseballHQ.com subscriber forums. Also, remember you can stay in contact with Baseball HQ on Facebook and on our Twitter feed at Baseball HQ. You can also follow my personal Twitter feed at Patrick Davitt, where you'll always be the first to know when a new podcast is available. Please tell your friends about Baseball HQ Radio. Take a second to go to Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, Pocket Cast or Spotify, wherever you catch your pods. Please leave Baseball HQ Radio a good review and a rating. That helps us find new listeners, and that helps us keep the podcast going. If your pod getter of choice doesn't find Baseball HQ Radio, please let us know about that or anything else on your mind by emailing bhqradio@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening. As we head into the regular season, we revert to our once-a-week model with our Friday full editions. I'm lining up our first flight of guest experts. We might have one on a show, we might have two, but they'll always be the top experts in fantasy baseball. And of course, we'll always have the usual great stuff, our weekly news analysis and our Baseball HQ commentaries, and it all starts next week on next Friday's full edition of the podcast with Fantasy Baseball Intelligence for Winners. It is Baseball HQ Radio. Talk with you again on Friday, and for now, so long.
Baseball HQ Radio is a weekly free podcast available through iTunes and other podcast aggregators, or directly from baseballhq.com, where we have an archive of past shows as well. Just look for the HQ Radio microphone logo on the right side of the baseballhq.com homepage. Baseball HQ Radio is a production of the USA Today Sports Media Group. The opinions expressed on Baseball HQ Radio are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of the USA Today Sports Media Group. The program is produced and edited by Patrick Davitt.